Hello and welcome to another edition of the In Context podcast. Again, I've got another friend of mine today. We've got Joel Kerrs. Every week I introduce people by calling them my friend to make out that I'm popular. But I generally have met Joel several times in Nidri. How are you doing, bro?
I'm good, and I would consider you a friend as well, bro.
Awesome. Nice one. So I've got at least two.
You've got two. You've got a friend in me.
Brilliant. And how are you doing, brother? You doing well?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I haven't seen you in, what, 4 years or so?
Yeah, it's been
Maybe 3 years, something like 3.5. Were you
in Nidri when lockdown happened, when all the Americans started?
I was in Nidri prior to COVID.
Right.
And I honestly, though, have enjoyed my conversations with you and been blessed by hearing of your ministry, man. So it's good to be on your show.
Great. And thanks for joining us. Yeah. So for those people in the UK who aren't aware of you, brother, can you just introduce yourself? Who are you? Who are you married to? And what is your ministry?
Sure. So my name is Joel Kerrs. I am born and raised in Akron, Ohio, which is the same city that LeBron James came out of. So he and I go way back, at least to the same city. And I moved to the state of Maryland on the East Coast. Moved here 19 years ago. I've been in Baltimore for about 12 years. We moved into an inner city neighborhood back in 2008 and began work on starting a church. And honestly, it was at the beginning, we didn't even know what we didn't know if it was going to be a church or if I was going to start a nonprofit. Like, I think I'm going to do a church, but I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to do. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I had very little training. So all that to say, it took us about 4 years before we covenanted together as a church. So in 2012, we essentially began a church, and that church is called the Garden Church. We're in West Baltimore, which is a tough neighborhood in the city. We probably deal with a lot of similar things that you guys would deal with in various ways, but we love it. And so we're going on 10 years. 10 years ago, January is actually when we covenanted as a church.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm married to Jess, and I've got 4 kids who are 4, 10, 14, and 16. Awesome. Crazy family.
So I think I've only met, when you came over to the UK, did you just come over with Jess and the youngest?
Yeah, I came over with Jess and my baby at the time, who is Chapman.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Awesome. And the church is called the Garden Church. It sounds like a similar story to mine, where I had no training. I didn't know what I was doing. I saw a need in a community, and we started working with the fatherless. We wanted to see a church planted, but I didn't know much about church planting. And a similar journey, we were just serving in the area, and a church developed. And I just wondered, how did that church develop from seeing a need in a community to go in there? What prompted you from just seeing a need to seeing that it was a need for a church?
Yeah, I think from the get-go, I had served as a youth pastor for 5 years at a church before that. And sorry about that.
No worries.
My phone is connected to my computer. And so if somebody calls, I'm going to turn my phone off. Yeah. But I had a desire to definitely be like a pastor of a church, you know, a community in the city. But when I moved into the city, though, I honestly didn't know. I think I was very reactionary to things that I'd seen in churches, and I just wanted to be different. And so we just floundered, you know, for a while and didn't really have any identity as a church. I mean, there was people that we were connecting with and doing things with and trying to serve, and I had a homeless guy sleeping on my couch. But yeah, around 2010 that I really kind of hit rock bottom, and I'm like, what am I doing? You know, I need to have like some kind of clear view as to what the church is, because I don't even know if I know what a church is, you know. I know what a gathering is like. I know what it's like to stand up in front of people and to preach to people, but what is the church? And what does that look like in this context? And so we connected around that same time, connected with Mark Dever at Capitol Hill Baptist Church. And they're about an hour from us. And so I had a cousin that was doing some work there at the time. And I was just hanging out with my cousin, and I connected with this ministry. And I'm like, wow, this is like a, you know, these people are pretty confident in what they think the church is, you know. And it really just kind of made me wrestle with my own thinking on like, what is the church and what am I doing, you know? And at that point, everything was so bad in our ministry that I was just so open to change and to rebuke and to being strengthened. And so that just began a process of like being discipled and reading and thinking, and it was a long process, but we kind of came out of all of that as a church. Awesome. In the city. Yeah.
Yeah. again, quite similar, and it strikes me how so many people, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe have been disillusioned with churches in the past, especially disillusioned with how churches are reaching areas of deprivation. So you see a need and you go, then I remember somebody said to me, what will you do when people get saved? And I said, wouldn't that be a wonderful problem to have, lots of new Christians not knowing right. what to do with them? And then all of a sudden you find out that you suddenly see conversions, and then you think, oh man, I wish I prepared a bit better.
right, exactly, yeah. That's how it was for me too. Like, it was honestly, I was challenged by some of the folks that ended up being converted or growing in our church. And they're asking me questions that I don't have answers to, you know, and I'm challenged to really think through, like, what is the church and what is discipleship and what does it mean to grow people in Christ and to teach them the word of God? So in a sense, like, some of our own people that we had that God was doing a work in were the ones that challenged me in my thinking.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you're ministering to this community. You've got a church there. Can you just share a little bit about what does your community look like within the church, but also outside the church too?
Yeah. Yeah. So the broader community around the church is a what we would call in the States an inner city community. I'm not sure if you use that term there, but it's a neighborhood that has been historically neglected in some ways since the 70s and 80s, big drug epidemic in the neighborhood, a lot of drug trade, a lot of corruption, I would say, in the city as well. So there's just some things that are in place that allow certain neighborhoods to struggle, you know, just a lack of good policing in neighborhoods and just you name it. So all that to say, that's sort of our context. It's resulted in a neighborhood that is mostly low income, mostly fatherless, or maybe I shouldn't say fatherless, but like dads don't live in the homes. Yeah. You know, I do think that there are dads that love their kids. There's some great organizations in our neighborhood that are trying to connect with fathers, you know, and I know there's dads that are trying to stay in their kids' lives, but with the cycles of poverty combined with hustling, drugs, you know, and then violence, so many young men who are dead in the streets, there's just this epidemic of no dads in the homes. So, so that's where we live. There's also, you know, we're in a city, so like not too far is some wealth and some people that have been there for a long time and you know, really established neighborhood with money. There is some development happening in our neighborhood, and you get some young professionals that have moved in, so there's a little, like, you know, question marks of gentrification, wondering how that's going to go. So we just live in all of that tension.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways our church probably reflects a lot of that. So our church definitely reflects the community right around us. We have a number of folks that are homeless or came homeless and are now in housing. We've got people that grew up in the neighborhood. We've got people that have just been moved around Baltimore City their whole life, or from a similar context from another city. We've got some that have come out of that and are doing well in life and working a job. And then we've got some that are passing through there in the city for a program, and they're looking for a gospel preaching church, and they ended up finding us on a website, and here they are. So we've got a mix. We've got a mix.
We've had a few of them. We registered with TGC, and some people who would come from Ireland presumed we would be a lot bigger and quite different because we were on the TGC website. Also, we'd never get on the Now Marks website. So we've had a few people join us. Fortunately, some of them stayed, but a lot were like, oh, this isn't what we were expecting.
Yeah. Bro, that same experience. Like, some of the ones that have stayed are our best workers. Yeah. You know, they get it. They're gospel centered. They help us with discipleship. They're wonderful. And that's in some ways like our middle class folks come through some of those websites. They're just looking for a church. But yeah, we've had so many people come who they come one Sunday and they look around and they're like, nah, this isn't what I was looking for, you know?
Yeah.
And if you saw where we meet on Sundays, it's so bad. I hope this doesn't get back to them. I probably should be careful as to what I say, but it's rough.
Yeah. Oh, mate, we've just had a ceiling repaired after about 9 months of, like, you could see the sun coming through and then the rain was coming through. And
nice.
But we've
nice. Got, yeah, we have a similar space, I think.
Yeah. It's humbling, but yeah, at least we have a building. And at least we had a roof to fix. So yeah. Always look on the bright side.
I know this is your show.
Yeah.
And I'm not supposed to interview you, but let me interview you really quick. Do you own your building?
Not yet. So we're merging with a small church. We looked to purchase a building just before COVID, and we were outbid, and the church that we were using sold it to a dance studio, yeah. So we ended up sharing a building with another small local church that didn't have a pastor. And since COVID, we've got on really well. We've merged, so we've decided to become one church. So we're looking to buy the building off their denomination. So hopefully we will own that building.
That's good. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
Love it.
Well, One thing we lack really in our area is diversity. We're very like homogenous. I think that the statistics for where we are, I think it's pretty much about 96% white. We're all working class, or we're predominantly working class. If there's anybody from pretty much no one migrates to Middlesbrough because there's no work. People leave Middlesbrough. So we're one of the only towns in the country that is actually shrinking in size rather than growing. But there is pockets, a bit like what you said, of areas of affluence. And this attracts middle-class people to the area. And then they'll come to our church. And again, I think sometimes people are put off by the lack of diversity. Your church is described, I love how you describe it. It says, let me just get this right. It says that you're a diverse church, but united by one commonality, and that's your need for Jesus. And share a little bit about the diversity within the church, some of the blessings that come from that. What does it look like on a Sunday and throughout the week?
Yeah, we are a diverse church. And, you know, I would say this. We don't think that the diverse church is the end-all, be-all. Like, I don't think that you have to be multicultural or diverse to really be, like, displaying the glory of God, you know? And I think that's important to say, too, because, you know, in your context, it would actually probably kind of weird if you were, like, bringing people in from the outside just to display diversity, right? when your own town is not all that diverse. Mm-hmm. But all that to say, we have enjoyed a diverse church. You know, we've got, like I said, people from the context. We've got people who are familiar with that context, but they're more middle class, meaning they, you know, kind of came out of it. We've got people that are passing through the city from a totally different context. You know, I'm not from Baltimore City myself. I'm an outsider originally. Our neighborhood is majority Black, and I'm white. Mm-hmm. However, we're only, you know, a couple blocks from a neighborhood that's probably majority white, but it's more diverse. So the diversity for us has been both probably a challenge, but mostly I would say it's a joy in that, like, you know, you see people who really are hanging out. They're engaging with one another in discussion. They're going out to dinner together. They're having each other into their homes. And you just give God glory because, like, man, they would never be doing this if it wasn't for the blood of Jesus, you know? Like, how would some, you know, guy with working a job who moved here from South Carolina be hanging out with a former drug dealer in Baltimore if it wasn't for the blood of Christ, you know? So that is that statement that you read. Was that on our website, or where'd you get that from?
Yeah, it was on the website, yeah.
Okay, I like it. I think it's a good descriptor. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
All that to say, man, I love the diversity of our church.
Because it's something that we battled against, because we started off to reach the local, like, working class, those who were missing from the majority of our churches.
Yeah.
But what we found was that culture quickly developed, which was intimidating for new people coming in who weren't from our culture. And I think we lost some good people. They were white, but white middle class. And they'd come in, and I think they felt, either felt intimidated or felt like they weren't welcomed. And I had to do some repenting. And I think I tried that hard to make people like me feel welcome, that I forgot about everybody else that lives in the locality. And
So in your church, the white middle class felt less welcome, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we had people from Hong Kong who stayed, people from Ireland who stayed, like middle class people, doctors would come, but local people, I think, felt more intimidated. Local middle class people felt more intimidated than people who were here just for short term as students or for training in the local hospital.
Yeah.
And so again, I had to bring in Nathan. Did you meet Prince Harry?
Prince Harry?
Yeah. No, I don't think so. So he's the lead pastor of New Life Church now.
Oh, I might have met him.
Yeah.
I think I have.
Nathan, so we brought him in. He's very middle class. He's from the south of England. And we've got some elderly people now who are middle class who come along. So it's a softer church. It doesn't seem as harsh for people coming in. It's looking a bit more diverse generationally. And class wise, so hopefully now when new people come, it'll be less.
No, that's interesting. I mean, the dynamic is real. You know, for us, one of the challenges has been the way that somebody who is, let me just paint a picture: the high school dropout, they've been selling drugs their whole life, maybe using drugs. Didn't grow up in, like, what we would consider to be a traditional family structure. They've never read a book in their life. Mm-hmm. You know, to have a church that has, let's say, majority folks kind of from that community is just going to look and feel different culturally than a church where people have advanced degrees, where most people read books, where people have expectations on what family is going to look like, kids, you know, and discipleship looks different. expectations on what's like going to be helpful is different, you know. So for us, one of the challenges we face is the more we have intentionally tried to stay focused on, like, we want to reach the community right around us, mm-hmm. you know, and I say intentionally because I'm an outsider myself, and I think there's always going to be a draw at some level for an outsider to attract other outsiders, yeah. you know, people who look like me. And so I have to intentionally keep our church focused on the neighborhood. Like, we need to be thinking about this community around us. And the more we've seen an increase in that, like you're saying, to some degree, the harder it's been to keep middle-class people.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't match all of their expectations of what church should be or what people should even be like in the church. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing, I still appreciate the diversity and love it, mm-hmm. but that's an ongoing challenge as to, like, how do we actually have a church that effectively reaches and disciples people from different economic backgrounds? Easier said than done.
Yeah. And then when you find that diversity, you find new problems to deal with, don't you? So,
right.
Again, just from styles of worship or the expectations of some people just want to come to church and then get off. Other people want to hang out all day. And
yeah.
Again, the tensions that come. But yeah, we were praying for so long for diversity. We start to get it and we start scratching our heads thinking.
Right, right. One thing we realized about a year ago, we did a little informal survey of our congregation, our elders did. And the question was, like, do you experience community in this church? And what we found was that people that were from more of a, more of a working class background, they said, yes, they do. People who came from, like, higher education, more upper class, middle upper class background, found it harder to have community in the church. And so then we began kind of peeling back the why. Why do you find community in this church? Why do you not find community in this church? And it came down to things like different cultural expectations on what community should be like, you know? So for example, one person might say, yes, I do find community in this church. And it's because I know that at any time I can just walk into somebody's house and eat it out of their fridge, and we just, like, do life together, and we don't have to schedule anything. I can just show up unannounced, right? But then somebody else says, no, I don't find community in this church. Why? It's because nobody invites me to their home for dinner or to go out to eat. And I don't really appreciate people just popping in my house. Does that make sense? And so this sort of, like, this, oh wow, like the cultural differences that come from class backgrounds are actually framing how people feel about the, you know, something like enjoying community in the church.
Yeah.
So yeah, what do you do about that? I don't know. It's interesting to know, but.
Yeah, well, I had the opposite. So I felt, like, offended when people would put me in the diary. I'd say, let's hang out. And they'd say, yeah, I can meet 2 weeks on Thursday at 7:30 p.m. I'm like, flipping heck, you treat me like your window cleaner. I'm
right.
An appointment. And not realizing that was, they were busy, the lifestyle they had meant the time was limited, and yeah. You could only fit socializing in.
Where yeah. And that's exactly what I'm getting at here, in that, like, what, like, they might think, man, Ian never schedules anything with me, therefore he doesn't value a friendship with me. And you're thinking, man, you don't, you're not available for me to just pop into your life. Mm. Therefore, you know, like, there's just this difference of culture and expectation.
Well, now I've got a new role. I'm working for Medhurst. We have a partnership agreement with Acts 29, so I'm supporting pastors and church planters within Church in Hard Places, and I'm sending people, I'm saying, let's hang out, let's meet, let's Zoom, let's talk. Here's my schedule, pick a date on Calendly, and I feel like such a fake, and I'm apologizing, saying, sorry bro, like, Well, obviously, it fits in with the schedule. Some people prefer clocking in a diary, but it's just so alien to me to arrange to meet a friend via a calendar.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you, bro. I think we scheduled this meetup through our Twitter Messenger app.
Yeah. Which I haven't been on since I sent that message. So.
Right. Me neither.
Yeah. So, yeah, you sent that message. I was like, I don't know why. Obviously, the Lord, but I just quickly checked because I've stopped following people because that's something else I've had to come off because I had my personal accounts and I was getting too involved in arguments that had nothing to do with me and weren't helpful. So I used the excuse of having ministry accounts and I still found myself jumping in on arguments that I shouldn't. And even if I didn't get involved, I was getting stressed out about some of the things I've read. So I've just, all I use it for now is posting the podcast and posting other information. Again, I don't know if that's a class. I think that just transcends all classes, being daft on social media.
Yeah, man. It can be deadly. It can drain you.
Oh, mate, yeah. I feel so much better and I have more love for other Christians since I've come off it.
Right. Well, praise God, man.
Yeah.
Probably I'll do the same thing.
Apart from the people who are following us, because that's where most of our funding comes from. So that's another thing, isn't it? I think a lot of social media has been good for promoting our work, but it's been a massive distraction for me as well.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I think there's always a tension for those of us that do partnerships and fundraising, and you know, we're trying to figure out like how do we make this ministry work, and how does partnerships play a role. There is always a tension there between like how much am I actually pouring into my people or taking care of this ministry at the ground level versus representing the ministry, which, you know, I think in your case, going off of the lead pastor role full time with Medhurst, probably a good move in that sense, because that way your people can have a pastor in a sense, you know, and you can focus on that broader development of Medhurst Ministries. Mm. But that tension, that was real.
Yeah, it's something I'm enjoying. This as a new season. The tension for me was, I don't think since I planted the church, after about the second year, I've never had a full year where I could concentrate fully on the church. I've always had fundraising in the back of my mind, partnerships, and after, it wasn't good for me because I was getting exhausted, and it definitely wasn't good for my people because they weren't getting the support and attention that they needed. But now we've got a good system with Nathan, AKA Prince Harry. He's leading the church now. And that's apart from the background. But again, you were, explain a little bit about your church, because not only are you a pastor, but you're director of One Hope. Mm-hmm. How did One Hope come about, and how do you manage that? And what is your vision for One Hope?
Yeah, so we established One Hope to help strengthen healthy churches in the inner city and to build healthy churches in the inner city. We have two guys right now that we're hoping to plant a church with, and that would be kind of through that One Hope platform. We're talking with a couple others as well. So really, One Hope is similar to Medhurst Ministries, similar to 20 Schemes in that sense. It's also slightly different. I think it's different is when we began One Hope, we were fundraising to bring on a gospel worker for our own ministry right here, because we just needed help. And, you know, our church was growing, but we were growing with people from the context, and we needed help with discipleship and a lot of social development of, you know, people, such as like, for instance, job training. We could outsource that, but at the end of the day, working a job is a discipleship issue. You know, it's part of growing as a Christian. What does God say about work? Why should you go to work? You know, so all of those sort of things are discipleship issues. So we wanted to be able to help fully disciple our people in a just simply a holistic discipleship kind of way, to where they're working a job and supporting their family and taking care of things, all as a follower of Christ. So that was when we first started One Hope. It was really just to try to raise some support to bring in some help for that. But at the same time, I realized at the same time, like, we are never, I want to see churches planted out of our church. Mm. And, you know, of course, God could like skyrocket growth and all of a sudden we've got, you know, a lot of money and people to work with. But if that doesn't happen, if we kind of just keep going, plodding along as things have been, which I'm fine with, mm-hmm. we're never really going to have the resources to be able to plant churches out of our church, right? Mm-hmm. But I think we've got some of the people. I think we've got some opportunities to do so. Mm-hmm. So what we did was when we were fundraising for that gospel worker, I just went ahead and created this whole new branding of One Hope. So that way I could kind of start building on that platform and hopefully start building up some support and some partnerships and a network so that once we have these guys ready to go to plant churches, we can actually have the funding and the partnerships, the resources to be able to plant churches. Does that make sense? So for that reason, One Hope is really just still part of the garden. It's the ministry of the garden. It's not its own entity. It's under the elders of the Garden Church. And we share a 501c3, you know, the nonprofit status. And will it eventually be its own entity? Probably. But at this point, there's no need because it's fairly small.
And what are some of the successes that you did? You struggle to find people to join you? Was raising the money easier than finding people to work with?
Yeah, as far as partnership development for One Hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, so on one hand, I have always been a fundraiser, as you have been. You know, ever since I started the church, I've always been hustling. So since 2008, been knocking on doors, trying to figure out how to make ends meet. I've worked part-time jobs and done different things, and part of that has been hustling to see if there's people that could help us. Mm-hmm. So when we started One Hope, we rolled all of our external partnerships into that One Hope relationship category. We had some momentum there already with, you know, some churches, not a lot, but a couple churches and individuals that had been helping us already. Yeah. And so that's how we started. What One Hope was with that. But yeah, fundraising it's excruciatingly difficult. It's time consuming. It's humbling. Like, I'm not the kind of person that likes to ask for help. And it's mainly because I'm battling my pride, you know? And to fundraise is to say, we need help. And I'm willing to actually ask somebody for that. And then also, it can be a little emotionally challenging because you get no's, you know? And I can't take that personally.
Yeah.
I've had to learn to not take that personally.
Yeah, that for me has been the biggest battle. I think there's some genuine unfairness in how churches and organizations give to ministries like ours. I think, so just for an example, having to fill it, I don't know if it's the same in America, but the application process is so difficult that what we're doing isn't quantitative. You can't put it down on a piece of paper. You have to see it firsthand to realize the value of what we're doing. You can't do it justice on paper.
Yeah.
And again, if people are looking at conversions or numbers or church membership growth before the fund year, we don't hit any of the targets that look backable. So again, so we face that I think a lot of the funders come from a business background and back churches with a business mindset rather than with a gospel mindset. So that was difficult. But I think in hindsight, the biggest problem I had was forgetting that, like you say, it's not personal if you don't get the money.
Yeah.
That I wasn't entitled to it. And see, if I don't get it, then the Lord has some control over that, if not all of it. It's like the Lord will provide. And again, I was putting so much trust in people, in grant organizations and trust, and not spending enough time praying and trusting in God.
Right.
And reflection over 10 years of ministry, that was my biggest failure, trusting in man for finance and not trusting in God for it.
Yeah, that's good, man. And also, to recognize that, like, my friendship with folks and relationship development with potential partners has got to be genuine and not just about getting their wallet, you know? Like, I've definitely asked friends for support if they would come alongside, if they're a pastor of a church, and I know their budget, and it's like 18 times larger than ours, you know? And I'm like, could you just give us like just the, you know, just a small slice of that pie? And I get a no. Mm-hmm. But I still love the guy and I pray for him. And, you know, I've preached in churches of after I've got no's from people, you know, and it's just, and I get it. Like they've got their view of what they want to support. And for whatever reason, we don't fit that view. So we've got to guard our hearts, I think, to not just use people who have resources, you know, and organizations. But yeah, I do think too, it's skewed here as well. I think it's challenging. You know, like you'd said, I think, how did you say it in the UK? The forms, the applications to fill out, like, so for us, it could be that, but I think, maybe this is similar to the UK, but for us in our evangelical world, there's such a focus on church planting. It's like, when I say church planting, I mean like, you know, a 2 to 3 years support to get a church off the ground.
Yeah.
But the development stage of that church planter, which could be 8 or 10 years, you know, the development of a ministry through which church plants could be birthed, long-term support for church planters, like that stuff that I don't think we have thought through well. And I'm not sure if we have good answers as to what that looks like to fund that in hard places.
Yeah.
You know, because that is funded in well-to-do places, you know, through middle class, upper class ministries. You know, you get these large churches that are able to fund internships and large training programs and be able to produce leaders. And but when you get somebody who's from the context in a tough neighborhood, the amount of time that it requires to develop that individual into a potential elder or church planter is just astronomical, you know? And this is why we're not doing a lot of church planting in tough neighborhoods, is because we don't have any kind of real system in place to be able to help develop and train guys from these churches, and even to build healthy churches in these neighborhoods that can become church planting centers. So it's a tough, I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about it because I don't want to become bitter. You know, I just want to keep my hands on the plow, my head to the ground, and keep doing the ministry I can do. I don't want to end up being like a bitter guy, like blaming everybody else, but there's work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
And I think what you're doing is kind of blazing the way in some degree and saying, hey, this is the kind of work that needs to be done. Who can get behind it?
Yeah. And again, I think what's brought me to my new role is the failures in my role as a pastor. So I'm supporting pastors and planters now, trying to help them avoid the mistakes I made as a planter and a pastor myself. And again, that frustration wasn't just like bit against funders. I was finding myself resenting other church plants that were getting funding rather than giving thanks and praising God for his generosity. I was like, why, Lord? Why not me, Lord?
Right. I know that feeling. That's what I'm saying. We've got a battle against.
Yeah. And that drains you as well. That's a huge, that constant spiritual battle with your own pride, your ego, your resentment, but also a righteous anger. It's hard. It distracts you battling these emotions and feelings. And we're supposed to be focused on the mission, but often we're focused on just keeping our own heads straight to keep
it. Yeah, it's when you feel like you're drowning, it's hard to rejoice with those who rejoice.
Yeah.
But we're still called to.
Yeah.
Now, and if you and I can figure that out, it'll help us in our discipleship of our own people who are struggling, and they're called to rejoice with those who rejoice, who just got a pay raise and they can't find a job, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a humbling journey, and I feel a bit more peaceful, a bit more calmer in this new role, but I'm sure I'm only 5 weeks in, so I'll let you know in a year's time if I still feel peaceful and calm.
Congratulations, man. I think it's wonderful to be able to plant the church and then pass it on to another lead pastor. Well done.
Yeah. I only did it so when it fails, he gets the blame.
Right. Yeah. Get the wheel of the Titanic over to somebody else right before it hits the iceberg, right?
I've got my life jacket on and I'm jumping in that lifeboat. Oh, but seriously, I mean, we've discussed some of these problems, but it's something that struck me. I'm speaking with pastors in Africa and South America, in the US, across Europe and in Britain, and every pastor and planter that's working in an area of deprivation has so many similarities, whether you're working with addiction or the homeless or poverty or fatherlessness. Yet within the similarities, there's often a lot of unique struggles that we all face within our context. What kind of struggle, because you've been to the UK, you've seen Edinburgh and some of the schemes in Scotland. Now, what are some of the unique challenges you face in Baltimore that probably we don't see in the UK?
Probably guns. Yeah. Although I think I might rather face a guy with a gun than a machete or whatever they carry around your neighborhood. Gun violence is definitely a big problem in Baltimore City. And the fears that creates, you know, it's our people live with a lot of fear. And, you know, sometimes I think, like, my girls take public transportation to school. You know, I'm always trying to push my kids, like, out into the neighborhood, like, go ride your bike around the block, you know. And I think, like, I think the fears can be unfounded to some degree when you look at, like, what are the chances of, you know, something happening. It's probably pretty small. But nonetheless, so there is fear that people live with. And so that's a challenge. You know, another challenge that I think ties into that is people staying in the neighborhood. And I don't know how this is where you're at. It seems to me that in the UK, though, that people are a little more stable in their neighborhoods. What I mean by stable is they live there for years and years. It's not as transient. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but our neighborhood is extremely transient. Like, I moved here into the neighborhood, like I said, going on 14 years ago, actually. And it's a totally different neighborhood 14 years later. You know, all the kids that I knew back then are gone. You know, some are dead, but many of them are just gone. Families get out of the neighborhood. Everybody always thinks, you know, the neighborhood is the problem, and I'm going to move to north of the city, or I'm going to move to east, or I'm going to go to a different neighborhood, and that's going to be better. And I honestly think it's just this hopping around Baltimore City constantly, or what we call Section 8 housing, which is government subsidized housing projects. you get moved around in those. You don't stay in the same area often. People lose their Section 8 voucher and they end up having to do something else. So the fear combined with this transient, like, I want to get away, I want to get out, then what it's honestly just hard to know, like, what a neighborhood church looks like. You know, we have a big value of people living in the neighborhood and staying in the neighborhood. Sometimes it feels like, man, it's kind of like our middle class people that are staying here, because they're the ones who are less, you know, they have more stability in their lives. Just creates these unique challenges. How does that compare to where you're at? Do you feel like people, is it transient there, or do people tend to stay in your community? And
yeah, so traditionally very stable, mm-hmm. unless people climb up the social ladder. So if somebody goes to university, which isn't very often, but okay. if they do, they very rarely come back. They'll go to uni, find a job there, relocate. Again, the middle class will probably move on. People who've got social mobility, the poor generally stay in the same area because waste of time moving because there's no jobs to move. Do you know what I mean? The only reason to move would be to find work, which there isn't any.
Yeah.
What I found though is people who become Christians move on, and the excuse is, I don't know, we're called to go, the Great Commission. Mm. People go to Bible college and then they move somewhere else to do the ministry. And
yeah,
our problem is keeping people to stay, especially once they're saved. And okay. again, trying to preach that message about how Jesus spoke to Legion, and when Legion says, "Can I come with you?" And he says, "No, go and tell your friends and neighbours everything that I've done for you." And yeah. trying to encourage people to stay, to preach the gospel in their community. But it's hard because I have that conflict where I want people to stay and minister so the community is changed and transformed by the gospel. But then I also think, God, this guy's been stuck in this awful place for so long. Let him go and experience something different.
Right, right.
That conflict, there's a constant tension between me wanting people to stay, but also them experiencing something different.
Yeah. Where we tend to challenge people is just in your motivations. You know, like, it's okay to move to a nicer neighborhood. It's okay to get out of the city. If you know, maybe you want a yard. Like, we don't have yards in the city. It's all concrete, you know. And you've never had that. You want that for your kids. Like, I can't blame you, you know. There's nothing sinful about that. You know, I can't bind your conscience where the scripture doesn't bind your conscience. But what I can do is check your motives a little bit and just say, you know, are we sure that this is not like a finding identity in this thing? Like, if I get out of this neighborhood, if I live in a nicer neighborhood, then I'm a better person, or people think that I'm a better person. If that's the case, terrible. You know, stay where you're at. That's a terrible reason to move. So yeah, man. Definitely some unique challenges. Other challenges that we might have that would be different would be the diversity piece to some degree, you know, like the class diversity, number one. Like, I think class, I feel like, is a little more pronounced in the UK than it is here, that divide. Mm-hmm. But it almost makes it more challenging here, because I feel like people don't go walk around thinking there's much of a class divide when there actually is. Does that make sense? And so we could just say, oh, well, the way I do things is just normal. Yeah. But we don't realize that's middle class, or that's working class, or whatever you might call it, right? Mm-hmm. And then also ethnic mm-hmm. Divisions can be pronounced here as well. Christianity is a tool of oppression. Mm-hmm. Christianity is a European tool to promote white supremacy. It's the white man's religion. You know, that is very, very prevalent. That kind of thinking is prevalent here.
And how do you then, as a white pastor? So I've read
question.
Well, I've read Urban Apologetics, and Eric Mason does a good job of giving the apologetics for the very things you've said. But he's more likely to be taken serious by somebody within the black community than, say, a white pastor. How do you argue against these false thinking as a white pastor?
Yeah, it's challenging. You know, sometimes I was just telling somebody in our church this yesterday that sometimes my white skin works in my advantage in that it can be intriguing. Like, I'm interested in what you, a white guy who doesn't seem to be racist, you know, has to say on these things. You know what I'm saying? There can be an intrigue there that allows me to have some conversations with some folks that I might not otherwise have. And then it can also be a challenge. You know, there could be definitely people who just probably do, without me even realizing it, you know, write our church off as, oh, that's just that white man's church, you know. But one of the things that God's blessed us with, though, is black leadership. Mm-hmm. So while I'm white, our leadership is majority black in the church. And so that's just incredibly helpful. And also the fact that we've got people that are just hungry for the word. Mm-hmm. And are willing to say, okay, let's go to the scriptures and let's look at history as well. Oh, that's something else, is looking at history. I feel like I've always tried to show that the Christianity is not the white man's religion, that Christianity is birthed not in Europe, you know. I'm always trying to counter these kind of conversations before they even happen. You know, so that way when somebody hears something on YouTube or their neighbor says something, well, yeah, we've already been having those conversations, you know, and there's a sense of like apologetics that I've already been doing with folks before they even realize that they need apologetics, you know. So it's just basic discipleship, praying with people, conversations, studying the Bible together, and having a good team of leaders that helps.
Again, that's something, again, that strikes me and is so obvious. But every pastor I speak to, when we speak about the unique challenges, every challenge ultimately is faced by the same thing, and that is through prayer, through the gospel, through discipleship, isn't it? Trusting in the Holy Spirit. And,
Yeah. You know, I just was having a conversation with another white pastor in a I think it's a minority church, meaning he's as a white guy, he's in the minority in his church, but he's having some critique and some criticism coming at him about his inability to pastor people because he's white. And I just encourage him, and this is honestly just from my experience, like, it's okay to just listen and to listen and to sympathize and empathize with what's being said, and to not feel like you have to always defend yourself. You know, I think as soon as we start jumping into, well, let me prove that I'm not racist, let me prove that I am able to pastor you, that I have, you know, that my white skin doesn't get in the way. Like, I think as soon as we start jumping into those kind of arguments, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. You know, our very evidences are become nothing, because it's like, well, let me just tell you why that evidence, you know, doesn't count. And so I encouraged him. I was like, just, you know, just pray, preach the word, disciple people, and let your faithfulness speak for itself. Mm. You don't have to defend your ministry. Mm. So that's been probably, as I've been learning, that the most helpful is to just be chill.
A good piece of advice, yet really hard to put into practice when faced with all these different challenges.
right, chill though.
You've got some good support. You've had I say you just recently had, or have you got one coming up, like a weekender coming up, or have you just had one?
Yeah, we just did a weekender. We have a conference coming up, which we call the One Hope Conference. Yeah. Focuses faith alone, and Thabiti Anyabwile, who's a pastor in D.C., Shai Len, who's a part of a church in Philadelphia, and Alejandro Malero, who's a pastor in D.C., and myself are going to be speaking at it.
Awesome. Yeah, again, so blessed to have these brothers around you who can share support. Your brothers, like Deva, you're still in contact with my Deva and stuff like that. So having that kind of wise counsel is something that's been essential for keeping my head in the game and keeping me chill at times of times of pressure and times of thinking, do you know what, I've just had enough. So how long did it take you to build up this kind of support network that you've got then? People who were like advocates for you, who were working alongside you in this ministry?
Yeah, so when I first started out, I had a couple friends in Baltimore City that I'm still friends with today that I just kind of started with and grew together. Mm. So that was from day one, just a couple. More broadly was after I connected with Mark Dever in D.C., I was invited back in 2010, 2011, maybe 2012, I don't know. I was invited to a monthly pastor's meetup at their church there in D.C. And so I've been doing that for about 10 years, just every month, driving down the road to D.C. And that gathering of pastors is probably, it's like the most therapeutic time of my week to just sit there and talk about challenges. And all, most of those guys are all completely in a different context, which has been helpful for me. It's been humbling for me because I think for a while I thought like nobody gets my ministry because of my context. Mm-hmm. And I've come to realize like, no, ministry is just tough everywhere. You know, the guy that looks great in the suburbs, he's killing it. He's got this big church. He's got a lot of money. He's actually got the same kind of challenges I have. Mm-hmm. He's trying to help people stop, you know, looking at porn and steward their money well and come back to his wife and ultimately grow in his understanding of Christ and the gospel. And, you know, people are challenging. So having that brotherhood of support has been going on for probably about, I don't know, 8 to 10 years or so. And it's just been game changing for me.
That's what I found with myself. You mentioned earlier, we have, I think to plant a church, there's an element of pride that every planter has. I think that's what gives them the motivation to do it.
Right.
But we have pride when it comes to asking for help with finance, but we also have pride when it comes to asking for like wise counsel, don't we? And
yeah,
I had to fight to find it because there was none on the doorstep.
And yeah,
this is what I'm trying to encourage with some of the lads that I'm working with now. It's essential that anyone has a group of men around them that can speak into their lives, pray for them, and again, point out that, do you know what, we can feel like victims at times, like you said, that we're the only ones who struggle in ministry, and just that humbling of seeing that ministry is just tough, whatever context is essential, isn't it?
And we're on the same team, you know? We don't need to be villainizing each other. Yeah, I think to be humbled is to say, you know, I don't know what my strategies are for the next year. Like, I don't know. I think I've got a good vision, but I'm not sure. You know, I think this is, I'm confused as to how to disciple this person. Like, those are the kind of things that, for whatever reason, church planting seminars don't teach you, you know? And you get into it and you feel like you have to have all of the answers to everything and you have to portray like this confidence in your ministry. It's hard to sometimes even talk to church planters because I'm like, look, stop playing with me. I know you don't know everything, you know? Just be real with me. Just talk like a normal person. And, you know, tell me about your core team. Like, don't make it more flowery than it really is. Let's just have a real conversation here.
Definitely.
But I see myself in those guys too. That was my point.
Yeah. That's why I know they're all jokers, because I was one of the biggest. So, we're coming to the end now. So, again, don't be proud. Let me know how we in the UK can be supporting you in prayer. And how can we support One Hope if there's anyone listening who would like to hear more about what you're doing and support the work that you're doing out there?
So one big practical need that's on the horizon for us is a building for the Garden Church. There's a potential purchase of a building in our neighborhood this month, where there's a building that might go on sale. We're praying that it does go on sale, and we think that we'll have the money, or we think that it'll be offered with a reasonable, it'll be put on the market at a reasonable price, and we can afford it. So I'll be praying that we get this building, because like I said, where we meet right now is just, it's tough. Yeah. And so a building would be wonderful for us. Pray for that. Secondly, we've got a couple folks that we are hoping to plant a church with in the next, could be a year to 3 years. Still working through some timeline stuff. So just pray for wisdom on what it looks like for us to plant more churches. Mm-hmm. Pray for the funding, of course, that would be necessary for that. Pray for people and workers to come alongside to develop core teams for those church plants. We're looking to plant in some of the toughest neighborhoods in Baltimore City first. And all that to say, I'm excited about that. And it's also daunting because we're in a tough neighborhood ourselves, so we just need a lot of support. And honestly, fundraising, like the overall representing the ministry, I enjoy doing it, but I don't have a lot of time to do it because I'm also, neck deep in pastoral ministry. So just be praying for whether that's volunteers or added staff, like wisdom on like what that looks like to both plant churches through One Hope as well as be faithful on the ground with the Garden Church.
Nice one, brother. What I'll do is I'll put a link up to the Garden Church website and to the One Hope site, and people can subscribe to your prayer letter as well via the website. Is that right? I get it.
Yeah. OneHope.gives, and you can subscribe to the prayer letter.
Brilliant. Yeah. Awesome, brother. Oh, Joel, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining me on the In Context podcast.
Awesome. Thanks, man. It's been my pleasure.